You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is... Till Death and the entire Rockwell Returns Files series is now available from Audible.com. A laugh-out-loud, communist-punching adventure. Sam Rockwell came home from the Second World War to work as a fledgling private investigator specializing in helping returns. Recently deceased ghosts who've come back with unfinished business. Check out this audiobook clip from Book 1 of the Rockwell Return Files series. From author Jason Anspach.
Unbelievable. Alice entered the dining room and saw her husband standing with his coat draped over his arm, his hat still resting on his head. Take your hat off, Frank. Now, about the pot roast. Frank pulled his hat tightly to his head, slightly twisting it in defiance. He saw on the table an alien supper, seeking his approval from White China. With hands rooted to his hips, he lifted a desolate face to Alice. No pot roast, he whimpered. I'm sorry, it's just that Colette Peterson... No pot roast, even, he exploded. A man like me never catches a break. I tell you, the nerve of some people. You're being unreasonable, dear. We can have pot roast tomorrow night. Not you. Them or him. However many it was. And on bowling and pot roast night. Frank circled a finger in the air for emphasis. That's what really steams me. You're not making any sense. What happened, dear? Alice asked, crossing the room toward her gesticulating husband. What happened? Frank echoed, his face red from the effort. The worst day of my life, that's what happened. Oh, darling. Alice closed the gap between herself and her husband and felt a matrimonial pull to rest her hand and head on Frank's chest, something that always seemed to soothe him. Her eyes widened in surprise as her hand passed through his body, like a wind through fog. Frank! Alice yelped with a backward jerk, hastily removing her hand from the chill miasma. Did you... die today? It is, Frank said, removing his hat to bring it slowly to his bosom. As you say. In reverence for his now past life, he screwed his head slightly up and to his right, staring into the heavens. Alice took another step back as Frank held his pose. It was an exact imitation of a statue he once saw of Admiral Porter. Frank felt resplendent with somber and regal airs. He waited for the sobbing to begin. You look ridiculous, Alice said dismissively.
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Jasper Ford on the show with me today. Jasper is a multi-talented writer, and I'm excited to dig into his creative process today. But Jasper has a brand new book that is out everywhere. It's called Early Riser. And I think you guys are really going to love this book. Welcome to the show, Jasper.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Jasper, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Wow, that's a great one. yeah, it's an interesting one, actually, because I didn't know that I was allowed to be a writer until I was 27.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, wow. That is, and this is something that I do a lot of school visits now, and this is something that I always try and drum into people. It's not something that other people do, right? Anyone can do it. You diligence, you know, it helps if you've got an imagination and you just sit down and you just, you know, practice at your ass and eventually, you know, you'll get there. But the point was, I grew up with, it was a very academic family, right? So for me, as a child, being non-academic, you know, I was like, you know, the academic failed underachiever. And because if you live in, you know, in the shadow of two elder brothers who are both at Oxford and both, you know, got doctorates and degrees in this and that and the other, I always maintained, you know, to myself that the yardstick of sort of, you know, academic prowess was, you know, going to university and all that huge amounts of learning and stuff. And that you can't write unless you've done that. And of course, that's just so totally wrong. So it wasn't when I started actually sitting down and starting to write for quite a peripheral reason that I suddenly went, I think I might be able to do this. I really do. And yeah, and I was 27 and already married and with two children. So it's an odd one, but it just shows that, you know, it can just strike you quite late.
Well, I hear a similar story to that from writers all the time, that there is a moment in time where in one moment, it seems like books are just magical and ethereal and just show up out of nowhere. And something happens where the writer realizes that humans actually make these. And I also am a human. Therefore, I can make this as well. Was it that kind of, obviously it was not that kind of awakening, because you were fully aware, I'm sure, that you've met writers and seen them on television and read their books. And we know these are real people, but what was it that gave you the sense of empowerment, that this is something that I could do?
It was doing it. I mean, it's interesting, but because I think I was always destined to work in story in some form or function or another. And I remember at the age of 9, I realized that movies were made, right? Because I saw a film where people were actually making a movie, and there was a camera and there was a microphone and makeup and hair and all that kind of stuff. When I saw that, and I saw this smoke and mirrors, this world of make-believe, that you can create something that on one side looks like a James Bond baddie lair, but on the other side is just plaster and 4x2. And that magical world of make-believe, I found immensely attractive. So I knew at the age of 9, I wanted to get into films. And I did. I got into the films when I was 20, and I worked for 20 years in the movie industry. But I think what I wanted to get into was story. And I saw movies as the way to do it. So learning to write, or discovering I could write, was me. I was writing film scripts to try and become a director, because you can always write your way into the film industry. If you write a really good script, a corking script, yeah, I always feel there's no way it can't not be made. But they weren't very good. So I then started writing long treatments to my film scripts. And the long treatments were essentially short stories. And I was doing this, you know, writing down this story, which I wanted to make into a film script. And that was the moment when I went, oh, yeah, I can do this. I think I can do this. And why not? Why haven't I done this before? But it really had not been on my radar at all to be an author, ever, until that moment when I sat down with the laptop and started writing this story. And then I forgot about writing film scripts. I went, no, it's great fun. I just wrote short story. One became longer, book. And then another 6 years after that, got published.
Nice. I love when we use language like, I was destined to be a writer. You know, there are a few careers, and, you know, we could argue whether writing is a career. Funny. There are a few careers where you can use language like, this was something I was destined to do. I'm gifted to do this. I have the storytelling gene, I like to say. Because it's kind of one of those things that you're either born with it or not, and it may wake up at various times in life. But you're kind of equipped from birth to be a storyteller. And some people that manifest in songwriting, and some people in script writing, and some people in book writing. But it's always going to find a way to come out, I've learned.
I think so, yeah. I mean, one thinks about it quite a lot, and I've been on, you know, I teach, you know, writing courses and things like that, and help other, you know, in festivals about teaching writers. But I think it kind of boils down to a good imagination and a propensity for hard work. You know, if there are two things that you need to be an author, I think that's probably, you know, down there. You've got to be able to sit at a keyboard for a decade if required, and you've got to be creative. You've got to think up some unusual stuff that other people aren't thinking about. You've got to have ideas that other people aren't having. Otherwise, your books look a bit Me Too-ish, don't they? And we you know, that's not so engaging. So, yeah, but having that imagination and that creativity, that is something that's very difficult to teach. And I think that's something that you have to have been brought up with as a child, you know, to want to make those connections. You have to want to make bizarre connections to be a creative person.
So, Jasper, when you first started writing, you know, the scripts, which became short stories, which, you know, became novel length work, what types of stories, were you writing? What's the thing that fires your imagination up initially?
It's good. It's actually a really good question, because I've been writing in the same way, for since that very, very first short story. And only sort of figured out how to put a label on it about 7 years ago. I mean, writing since 88 now, so, you know, quite a long time. But what it is I write by something that I call the narrative dare, right? Now, what this means is you set yourself a little task, right? And let's just say for the Air Affair that I got published in 2002, it was Jane Eyre is kidnapped out of the original manuscript of Jane Eyre. Everyone's copies are blank from page 200 on, and someone has to get her back. Right. That is a Jasper narrative dare. Humpty Dumpty is a police procedural. There's a narrative dare. In Shades of Grey, it was write a world order that's based entirely on visual colour. What else? And this one, of course, the one I'm working on at the moment, Early Riser, sorry, the one that's published at the moment, is write a thriller based in a world in which humans have always hibernated. So what I do is I kind of set myself this, you know, major task, and then I unpack it. I unpick it. I go, okay, hibernation, humans, how would that work? We've always been like this, so our society is based around hibernation. And how different would we be taking into account what humans are kind of like? You know, so there will be mischief, there will be romance, there will be this, there will be resentment, there will be sacrifice, all these sorts of things. But it's in a slightly off-kilter, different way. And it's the same with all my writing that I've done, is essentially take that narrative dare and then run with it. And I have a couple of narrative dareettes as well in there, you know, just to sort of make things exciting. But the thing about a narrative dare is you can't not do it, right? That's the really important thing about a dare. I can't go, you know what, this hibernation thriller, it just isn't working. I'm going to go and write a romance about two people who like each other a lot, you know. And you go, well, that sounds really boring already, you know. So the fact that it's a dare is you cannot let yourself off the hook. And what that means is that you sometimes have to burrow more deeply in your imagination, in the authorial toolbox, to try and make the idea work in a way that functions, that is funny, that's sad sometimes, that engages with the reader. And when you do that challenge, you learn new things, new skills, new ways of telling stories. It's worked for me. You know, and it's kind of worked, really. But that's basically what I do.
Yeah, absolutely, it works. Mm. And the narrative dare. I love that concept. Mm-hmm. And it really seems to work well. The way you do it, and Early Riser is a little different. Your new book, and we're going to talk all about that in just a minute. But I would argue that it's not. Maybe not quite as different as it may seem on the surface. One thing that it looks to me that you love to do is take these common notions, especially, you know, your literary work. Let's take Jane Eyre and let's turn that story on its head, and let's expand that world, and let's do things to these characters that we know and love and respect, and let's see how they would behave in our world. Is that something that excites you, to take something that people maybe have firmed up in their mind that they feel one way about it, and then kind of shake it up and turn it on its head?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. I mean, you've hit the nail right on the head. I have a different way of explaining it. Because the Thursday Next books are all about, you know, I call them books about stories, stories about books. And then the nursery crime series with Humpty Dumpty and the Three Bears and Goldilocks. And what I'm doing is I'm looking at them in a different way. And what I'm doing, I think, and what I describe it as, is moving the furniture around in your head. Because the thing about Jane Eyre and Edward Rochester and Grace Poole and all those characters within it, they are fairly rigid in one's imagination, because that's how you've kind of read them. It's like, you know, nursery stories. But when I start saying things like, you know, the three bears, well, Mummy Bear and Daddy Bear were sleeping in separate beds. So, you know, that points to marital discord within the bear family unit. Then I've moved the furniture in your head, and all of a sudden you can see something behind that table that you couldn't see before. And it's amusing and it's exciting and it's a little bit, you know, engaging. So that is exactly what I'm doing, is I'm taking stuff which is fairly rigid in our heads, and I'm playing with it in a way that is exciting and unusual and playful. So that's absolutely what I like to do.
And playful is a great description there, because you take these things that are very rigid for a lot of us, and some of these stories we read in university as proper literature, and they should be not messed with. But you playfully do that, and in being playful, you get to dodge being disrespectful. Does that ever concern you, or are there any taboos that, you know, this is something we can't do to this piece of literature or these characters, or is everyone fair game?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think so. I mean, I call it being reverently irreverent, is what I describe it as. And yeah, I mean, it was interesting when I did the Air Affair years ago. I thought that because I was playing a little bit sort of fast and loose with these literary characters, I thought there might be, you know, hardcore Bronte fans who would, you know, firebomb my house because they were so angry at what I'd done. But then I started meeting fans of Jane Eyre, and I met somebody, and she said, you know, I did my doctoral thesis on Jane Eyre. And she said that as an opening gambit, you know, so it's high, you know, mindset. And I went, oh my God, you know, here it comes. She's going to beat me senseless, you know, with a brick. And in fact, I said, you know, how was it? And she said, it was great. It was like the world I wanted to live in, because you knew the book, you understood the book, you understood the shortcomings of the book, and you were just having fun with the characters, but in a respectful manner. And I went, oh, thank goodness for that. You know, that's a huge, huge, huge relief. So in the most part, you know, that strange language, that strange unspoken language that readers have, where we have this kind of shared engagement in story, I think there's an understanding amongst us. And I think, you know, that if I'd been sort of fast and loose with Jane, the character of Jane, then I think, you know, it could have put people off my writing. But I didn't want to do that. And I really like the character, you know, and it's like a shared understanding of these sort of classics. In the same way, also, though, I say that some of them are a bit boring. You know, that went down equally as well. You know, when I was in one of my books, somebody has to read the 10 most boring classics, you know, which include, I think, Pamela and Moby Dick. And a lot of people said, yeah, I found them boring, too. So, you know, classics aren't all brilliant. They just can be a little bit dull, too.
In Shades of Grey, you're taking... really taking a good poke at societal structure and maybe inherited you know, value and the idea that a person can be born with a particular name or a particular lineage, and they are you know, automatically afforded things that other people are not, and you take that concept and really shake it up with people having or born with a certain ability, and it's, you know, no control of their own. What did writing a story like that allow you to explore that you just can't explore, you know, at a cocktail party or something when you're talking about the real world?
Well, it's kind of, I suppose, it's speculative, and the great fun thing you can do with fantasy and satire is to question the world in which we live without being challenging to those who might have opposing views, which is a bit sort of cowardly, I suppose, in a way. But it does allow you to examine issues, and certainly the rigidity of the class system, of the color class system in Shades of Grey is something I wanted to look at. There are all sorts of interesting things that fascinate me about reproductive politics and marriage markets, which are not talked about at all. No one talks about, apart from me, and I bring it up at dinner parties about marriage markets, no one really talks about it. There was an interesting chapter, I think, in Freakonomics, perhaps, that touched on it. And I'm sure there are books. I'm sure there are many, many books written about it. But we do have very narrow marriage markets. And it was kind of something I wanted to just sort of look at. But it was also in the way that Shades of Grey was a very speculative book, in that it is trying to be very absurd and silly and almost slapstick on one side, but then also be very, very serious on the other. You know, is this a serious book? Is this a silly book? I don't know. Well, it's somewhere in between. And that is something that I wanted to try and do with that book. And I think, you know, I like to think it works quite well on that basis, although a little bit out there.
Another author who did that so well was Terry Pratchett, that could really dig into some serious issues while making us laugh or getting lost in this fantasy world. And since his unfortunate passing a few years ago, we're lacking those voices that challenge us in a humorous way. And I'm so happy that you are doing that. It's a great thing. It's a great tradition to carry on, for sure.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Your new book, Early Riser, tell us the premise of this book. And when a new story comes to you, or new premise, how does it come to you first? Do you normally get a character? Do you get a setting? Is it a plot device? Is it just a what if premise? Like, how do stories begin to form with you?
Well, it began with that narrative dare, I think, with this notion of humans hibernating. So I was out walking the dog or something like that, and I suddenly occurred to me, you know, what if humans hibernated? And because this is how I fill my, you know, time when I'm not writing. And I suddenly started to think, actually, there's probably quite a lot you could do with that. So it was really a question of saying, right, okay, let's figure out the world, because the interesting thing about writing fantasy or speculative fiction or absurdist fiction or whatever you want to call my writing is that you can make a lot of interesting new dramatic possibilities by changing very small things in humans. For instance, you know, if everyone had three legs, for instance, in a world of everyone had three legs, how would we regard someone with only two? And that would be, for me, an interesting little thought experiment. So it's, you kind of start off by that. But the drama would come from only having two legs in a three-legged world. And in the same with Early Riser, the drama actually and the plot really started to evolve once I'd started fleshing out this world, putting some characters into it, playing with the characters, seeing how they interact, get a notion of what the world, what people can do in the world, what they can't do, what are the gateway guardians, all these sorts of things. And then the plot starts to sort of emerge from the gloom, only because you different dramatic possibilities. I think a good example of this is in Shades of Grey. For some reason, there's this book, the Book of Munsell, that everyone has to adhere to no matter what, no matter how daft it might seem. And there was obviously a misprint, or somebody left out the manufacturer of spoons. So in the Shades of Grey world, no one's been making any spoons for about 700 years. Now, that obviously has some knock-on effects, both social and economic. So it's new possibilities of drama from changing a very, very small aspect of human experience. And that was essentially what I was doing with Early Riser. We have to sleep for 4 months. We have to bulk up. We have to almost double our body weight to be able to survive until the spring. Surviving till spring is not guaranteed. And that means probably that there might be some socialized childcare, because the people who bring you up might not necessarily be your parents. How would that work? And all of a sudden, the world becomes more complex and motivations start appearing, and the whole thing starts to work.
as you're coming up with this idea and you start playing the what if game, what if we hibernated? What if childcare becomes an issue? What, you know, the one what if starts escalating outward pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I have all these sort of tenets by which I write by, you know, the narrative dare, the never ending pursuit of a lame joke, which I do quite often. The less well trodden path, that's a good, really good one to do. But the logical progression of an idea is a tenet by which is very, very strong. Is once you start with an idea, it has to be taken to its logical progression. You can't just say, oh, we hibernate, we go to sleep and then we wake up in the spring. You go, no, it's got to be more complicated than that, because the reader, and readers are very, very imaginative people as well, will start saying, yes, but what about so-and-so? You know, and these little, you know, little empty gaps in the narrative, I think, annoy people if they're not there. So I like to try and second guess what people are thinking, because I'll be thinking it myself. And I'd be saying, no, okay, socialized childcare. And then I introduced this, these order of, nuns who, quite the reverse in our world, actually have as many children as possible, because mortality over the winter is very high. So they, you know, have tons and tons of children. So they're called the Sisterhood of Perpetual Gestation. And then you go, okay, well, that's probably a good place for my character, Charlie Worthing, to have been brought up. Let's have Charlie there. Let's have Charlie a remaindered orphan, because I like the saying the last child in the orphanage. You know, it's a terrible thing to say. You know, the last one to be picked. And I go, okay, what if Charlie were the one who never got picked out of the orphanage? Let's play with that. Someone who has skills, who has things that they want, but they have a little bit of baggage. They're slightly lacking in confidence. You know, let's put them into a dark place and see how they blossom. And that's kind of, you know, how the whole thing sort of starts, really.
You chose to tell the story in the first person perspective from Charlie. So we as the reader are Charlie. What did that afford you in the telling of the story and exploring this world by having us not having that omniscient narrator, but seeing the world and all these experiences through Charlie?
I think I've done nearly all my books bar two as first person narrative. I do like it. I like it. I think the biggest drawback, obviously, of a first person narrative is that you can't know what else is going on. You know, that you can't know what's just behind the hill, what's behind the closed door. And I like that. I like that a lot. There's a sense of being slightly at sea, which I enjoy about first person narratives, and also really getting into the character, what they're really thinking, you know, warts and all. The self-admission that you have to yourself, I think, is very interesting, because, of course, we promulgate, you know, this perhaps notion of being a confident person to everyone around us. Yet inside, you know, there's this sense of, you know, I think, worry that nothing's quite right, or just small little things that aren't working for you. And I just like sort of really getting into that with my first person narratives. And I think it seemed to work fairly well for Charlie, as Charlie tries to navigate this dark time in the winter, which is totally outside their experience.
Jasper, as we read Early Riser, what is something that readers might find fascinating or might surprise them, that when you're exploring this world and this scenario, what are some things that you learned about us and about you know, our human nature, maybe, that only is uncovered through telling this kind of story?
I think that in a fantasy world that human nature is a universal. You know, the characters I'm writing about are different from us, but they're not so very different. That people can be awful and, you know, and venal, but they can also be kind and giving and generous and afford huge sacrifices. And I think it's also Charlie getting to know what it is to be a member of a team. You know, that I think there's a sentence about halfway through the book, which is, you know, it was at that point I realized why the Winter Consuls, which are these characters who look after the sleeping masses, why people wanted to be Winter Consuls. And I knew at that point why I'd never want to be anything else. But up until that point, you know, Charlie's like terrified of what's going to happen. But I think there's that realization of belonging, I think, perhaps, that I bring into it. I'd like people to understand perhaps about that, and perhaps a little bit maybe self-sacrifice. But also, I every now and again, I throw in some new piece of information that perhaps makes you reappraise the story that you've read so far, which I like to do. I'm trying to do it more and more in books. But just all of a sudden, things are slightly turned on their head because you've got this new piece of information. And those sort of pop into the book at regular intervals. But just enjoy yourself, really. Just I hope it's an enjoying read. I mean, that's basically, I'm here to entertain, I think. That's what I'd like readers to get from it.
Jasper, your website, jasperford.com, is a joy to dig into and peruse. I absolutely love it. You kind of have this giant repository of this. Just kind of followed your life and career over the last a lot of years. What do you hope to accomplish with your website? And when people visit there, what can they find out about you?
Well, it's partially it's after sales service. So if you want to know a little bit more about the book that you've just read, I always have a special features section. So you can, I don't think I did for my children's book, actually, but most of my books have a special features. And then I have what's called a making of Wordimentary and deleted scenes. And I usually go on a location recce around the areas described in the book. And it's really just to keep people, if they want to know some more, there is some more. And if you want to do something in between now and when the next book is going to be published, then you can have a look at that as well. But there's also some quite fun stuff and things about me if you want to know some more about me. Generally just sort of after sales service.
Early Riser is the new novel. I absolutely love what you're doing, Jasper. We're going to send everyone to pick up their copy of it. There'll be links to everything in the show notes. Other than your website, is there any place online people can connect with you?
Oh, yeah. I have a Twitter feed, which is Jasper Ford, and also Instagram, because I'm a keen sort of photographer. I like taking pictures ever since I was tiny. Instagram, and I'll have pictures are up there. I'm easily findable.
And Ford is spelled F-F-O-R-D-E.
Yeah, that's it. Bit of an odd spelling, but that's
But we'll put links to everything in the show notes. Jasper, I've had a great time talking with you. We wish you much success on the new novel. We're going to send everybody to see you.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. It's been good.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. Find all the archives at hankgarner.com. Now, stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
Natalie, it's Artie. Listen, I'm going to be late for dinner. I ran out of gas on... He climbed out of the car and peered at the sign. On Sleepy Hollow Road? There's nothing but trees, and I have to find a gas station. Save me a drumstick. He hung up his cell and stuck it in his pocket, zipping his jacket. He was going to have to walk and pray somebody picked him up. A sliver of crescent moon hung above, surrounded by clouds, like a grinning drunk asleep in a puddle. Artie walked, using his tablet as a flashlight, eyes on the gravel ahead. He crossed over a dark ravine. The trunks and overhanging branches were matted thick with wild grapevines and threw a cavernous gloom over the road. A figure stood at a crossroads ahead. It looked pale and wan and blue. A woman? He had an impression of fragility and age and thought of his warty old landlady. But his landlady would not be standing at a crossroads in the dark.
"Excuse me?" Artie said, surprised by the fear in his own voice. "Do you know where I can find a gas station? I'm empty."
"Then let me fill you," the figure whispered.
It rushed at him. It entered him. He dropped the tablet,
fell to his knees, and lost his body to another driver. When Artie woke again, he was dangling in midair. The woods were pitch black. The only lights were fireflies. Fireflies everywhere, like dancing stars. He struggled and cried out, his yellow sneakers trying to find the ground.
"Shh," said a voice. "It will all be over soon."
Panic rose. He felt invisible hands on his legs, on his arms, invisible fingers around his neck, reaching up the back of his shirt. He heard the sound of water running below, high and agitated, as if through a stony brook. The crescent moon swung out of the sky, falling into the water. Blood rushed into his cheeks. He realized he had been flipped upside down. He yelled and groped, flecking his own face with spit, helpless to drive away whatever was attacking him. He felt a sharp pain between his shoulder blades, and air flew out of his lungs. A spray of blood hit his cheeks, hot and clinging. His hands found a sharp branch protruding from his body. It had speared him through his back and out through his chest. He tried to say help, but had no air to form the word. Blood poured up his body. No, it poured down. It only felt as if it were rising, climbing his neck, covering his face, gathering in his scalp. He reached for the ribbon of blood that fell from his crown into the trickle of moonlight below. The ribbon slipped through his fingers. It thinned, choked, became a tiny rivulet. His tanks were empty. Not even fumes. His engine began to sputter. The flow became a drip. A maddening drip, like the drip, drip, drip of his kitchen faucet. The drip his landlady hadn't fixed. The drip that kept him up at night. This drip would not be keeping him up. He would sleep very well this night. Very well indeed. The fireflies slipped into shadow. A figure appeared, blue as gaslight, bony and toothless. A crone from a fairy tale.
"Thank you, my friends," she whispered. "I am thankful for this good harvest."
She neared, scrutinized him with manic intensity, and turned away, muttering to herself in a sing-song rhythm as she, too, vanished into the trees.
"A man may toil from sun to sun, but a woman's work is never done."